Alors, j'ai le plaisir de vous présenter Brian Evanson, que certains d'entre vous ont peut-être déjà approché de plus près, hein, et qui enseigne la théorie critique et la création littéraire à Brown University. Il est l'auteur d'une dizaine d'œuvres de fiction, dont trois romans, ainsi que des recueils de nouvelles. Ouais. La parution de son premier recueil de nouvelles en 1994, qui s'appelait Outman's Tongue, lui a valu les foudres de l'université dans laquelle il enseignait à l'époque, était Brigham Young University, et il a reçu l'opprobre des hautes instances de l'église mormone, à laquelle il appartenait à l'époque, puisqu'il était même prêtre mormon, à cette occasion. Il a donc préféré l'excommunion. Nication. I was right. Yeah. Oui, on a discuté sur. Oui, mais bon, j'avais raison. Désolée, mais c'est lui. L'excommunication en 2000, plutôt que de cesser d'écrire. Donc, c'est voilà, l'écriture ou la vie, peut-être, d'une certaine manière. Trois de ses œuvres ont été traduites en français. Une, Contagion, ici présente, qui a donc été publiée en 2005, qui est parue en 2000 aux États-Unis. Father of Lies, qui a été traduit par Père des mensonges, par Claro, qui a été publié en 2009. Et Inversion, The Open Curtain, donc Inversion a été publiée en 2007 en France. Et nous avons également, évidemment, La Confrérie des Mutilés qui est parue en France en 2008. Et actuellement, Brian travaille sur la traduction de Bardo, or not Bardo. Je ne sais pas si... Enfin, je pense qu'on va peut-être réserver certaines problématiques pour la table ronde, et notamment le lien entre Volodin et lui, sur la question de la communauté en particulier. Donc voilà, je vais laisser Brian parler.
J'espère que vous me pardonnerez de ne pas faire mon discours en français. Je vais le faire en anglais, mais ça ne va pas durer longtemps. Donc, si on a besoin de dormir, ça va marcher. I want to start by quoting Lieutenant Gregory in Stanislaw Lem's novel, The Investigation. Says Gregory in that book, "When I was studying physics, the section on optical illusions in my textbook had an illustration that was either a white wine glass against a dark background, or two dark human profiles against a white background. You only saw one or the other. And as a student, I took it for granted that only one of the two images was genuine, although to this day, I still can't say which." I begin with this simple quotation precisely because I see it as a metaphor for our thinking about literature, though we can often, when looking at a literary work, see it as either one thing or another. We have a hard time not taking it for granted that one choice is more genuine. Though our philosophy and criticism claim to have gone well beyond binary thinking, we still find ourselves falling rapidly back on such thinking when it comes to the specifics of a work and to considerations of genre. It takes a certain amount of effort not to think of a literary text as either science fiction or literary fiction, as either a novel or a poem, as either realistic or non-realistic. When we do find a work that doesn't neatly fit into one category or another, the tendency is either to force it into one category or to discard it entirely. The Lem quotation that I began with suggests something else about the image. Both of the effects, both of the ways of viewing the picture are optical illusions. Neither represents the picture so much as it does our way of viewing the picture. Each way of viewing the image is mutually exclusive. Though one can intellectually and perhaps virtually accept that both images technically can be seen, it is impossible to see both at once. The eye might be able to rapidly vibrate from one way of seeing to the other and back again, but there is never a possibility that the vibration will become so rapid that we will see both images at once. Nor, strangely enough, can we see the picture without interpreting it. We can accept that the larger picture is there, but we have difficulty seeing it all at once. We can only ever see it from one or the other perspective. In a sense, we've simply moved to another binary. We started with an opposition between the wine glass and faces. And maybe I'll show you this. I'm sure you all know this. You've seen this before. So you look at it one way, it seems like faces. And you look at the white, it seems like a wine glass. But it's very hard not to see either the faces or the wine glass. In a sense, we've moved to another binary. We started with an opposition between the wine glass and faces, then moved to a tension between the two images on the one hand and the picture as a whole on the other. We could perhaps move on to another level, to a further tension, the tension existing in the fact that the image only works as an image. It does not really function if we describe it, unless we've seen it already. Nor can I imagine any circumstance in which in life I actually could mistake a wine glass for a face or vice versa, unless I was very, very drunk indeed. The image only works because it deliberately misrepresents the real. In addition, people often do not perceive one, and sometimes both of the two images, unless they're told what to look for. So we have a deliberately artificial image whose relation to representation of the actual is tentative at best, and which is initially activated by something exterior to it. If there's a synthesis at work in this image, it is, to borrow from Deleuze's Logique du Sens, a profoundly disjunctive one, one that even as it affirms a connection, also suggests a cascading series of tensions that disrupt it. This for me seems a good place to begin considering the complexity of Volodine's work, if one adds in, as a kind of caution, a comment from a narrator in a chapter of Volodine's new novel, Écrivain. And now I will quote French as if it's a foreign language, which it is for me. Au fond, il n'y a pas encore l'image. Il y a seulement le noir-être. I've partly chosen to begin with Lem because he is one of those tricky literary figures who still remains hard to classify. For some, he's a science fiction writer and belongs in a literary ghetto labeled genre writing. For others, he's a literary writer with philosophical undertones whose science fiction roots can be justified, explained away, or dismissed. Neither is exactly the right way to look at him, nor exactly the wrong way, but both are, in some senses, necessary. Antoine Volodine poses similar problems, but in ways that I find much more complex. And these problems raise a series of very interesting dilemmas for his readers, his critics, and his translators. Indeed, more than any other writer I know, Volodine manages to create a world that feels at once palpable, multivalent, and real, and yet discontinuous and constantly shifting, as if threatening to fade from existence. His work demands that we move beyond the logic that we tend to rely on to understand fictional worlds. It creates its own systems and possibilities using what Jean-Louis Hippolyte calls a xenologic, a logic external to the structures of reason, and then rubs them out, modifies them, changes them. Volodine's world is a world that not only simultaneously can be read as oneric and real, as pre- and post-death, as real and unreal. It is a world that erases the distinction between these categories, that ultimately demands that we simultaneously manage the impossible task of simultaneously seeing a both-and and a neither-nor. At the simplest level, this is the same as Lem. There is a confusion of genre. Volodine is someone whose first four books were published in De Noël's Présence du Futur collection as science fiction. His work since then has been published in more strictly literary venues. The remarkable thing about this is that in these early science fiction books is that these early science fiction books are consistent with the program of the later books. So one might argue that Volodine is an author who went from being a science fiction writer to being a literary writer without changing his style, because of the way in which different publishers offered readers and critics a context for his work. This suggests also a remarkable suppleness to his project, but also suggests that readers are willing to see whatever image they are told to look for. If you also consider the work published under the names Manuela Dreiger and Elie Kronauer, we discover a consistency of project which crosses the boundaries between young adult and adult fiction as well. A further level of complexity in Volodine's work comes in the shifting levels of the storytelling itself. We can find this on the level of the story, for instance, in the way the narrator of Dome Dog can slip from first person to third person and back again. We also find it in the uncertainty of the narratives, the way in which Fullerton's narrators are often deliberately misleading, or perhaps mad, or perhaps simply amnesiac. But it's a deeper problem than that, since, as Leonard Ruffel suggests while reading Volodin in relation to Foucault, in Volodin's work, quote, le partage raison-folie constitutive du discours n'est plus opérant. If this is in fact the case, then Volodin offers a discourse that is not constituted, at least as we traditionally think of it, and we should be at least suspicious of approaching it with the standard tools that criticism offers us. This, in turn, is tied to Volodin's questioning of traditional Western fictional forms and their replacement with an alternative series of genres, tied as well to his preference for episodic structures that accrue a kind of meaning rather than following a traditional narrative arc, and to his incorporations of chants and prayers and dreams and many other things. We also find it in the way that sections of a Volodin text work together, in the glimpses and hints Volodin gives us from time to time of a larger narrative voice organizing or processing the text as a whole, but doing it incompletely. It's also visible in the permeability of levels of discourse, in the ways that a character or narrator can suddenly come to function exterior to a work itself as a heteronym. Take, for instance, the fact that Manuela Dreger's Deuxième Mickey was mentioned in 1998 in the list of books that concludes Le Post-Exotisme en 10 Leçons, Leçon 11, as something that would be published in 2003. And indeed, in 2003, Volodin, operating under the heteronym Manuela Dreger, did publish a book of the same title. Or consider the way this model is destabilized by the mention in that same list of the 1999 romance Cris au Tongfong Hotel by Türkan Marashvili, only to have it appear as a chapter in Lutz Bassmann's Avec les moines soldats in 2008. Is this simply a different text, or are Marashvili and Bassmann ventriloquizing one another in the same way that Gordon Coombe ventriloquizes his narratives in Bassmann's Les Aigles Pieux? Add to that the fact that Lutz Bassmann begins as a character in Le Post-Exotisme, and things start to seem very dizzying indeed. And this goes, in my opinion, dramatically beyond metalepsis. The result is that, as Ruffel suggests, quote, not only must the traditional author-reader model be weakened, but also the author-character relationship must be envisioned differently, unquote. One of the key features of Volodin's work comes in the echoes that operate between both within individual books and between books. Indeed, the more one reads of Volodin and his heteronyms, the more one comes to understand and even to reconsider what one has already read. One learns to read Volodin simply by reading him, and barring the fortunate immediate connection with a given book, it may well take 3 or 4 or 5 books for the reader to begin to grasp the complexity of his project. One's understanding of the Schlum section of Bardo or Not Bardo, for instance, is deepened if one has already met Pufki and Schlum, or versions of them, in Dome Dog. As Jean-Louis Hippolyte suggests, quote, Volodin affirms the function of text as matrix. Volodinian novels do not end, but branch out to other related texts that recycle some of their narrative elements, unquote. Thus, the nature of Dome Dog's writing in blood, near the end of the novel of the same name, is directly reflected in what the narrator traces with his finger on the steamed-up train window in Schlum, and one scene informs the other, mutually modifying our sense of both. These echoes do not create a clear sense of synthesis. They create as many tensions as they resolve. They complicate Volodin's world as much as they explain them. Because there are so many such echoes, and because so much about Volodin's work is deliberately unstable, I think one of the chief temptations of a translator is to overdetermine the work in the process of moving it from one language to the other, simply because so much of what makes Volodin's work powerful exists in the connection between books. One is tempted, particularly in English, where only 2 complete Volodin translations exist, to provide additional context, either through a translator's introduction, as Jordan Stump does before his translation of Des Anges Mineurs, or by subtly inflecting the internal workings of the text to make it make sense to readers. But I think for Volodin, more than for most authors, an unembroidered language very faithful to Volodin's original is the only thing that serves. Volodin's novels, too, are wary of literary references, and most of the time they consciously steer clear of them. They make an effort to situate themselves outside of a system of official literature. It is thus very important that the text is kept in suspension from the culture of normalized literature, instead of being plugged into pre-existing categories such as surrealism or post-postmodernism. One must take steps not to fold the translation into one of the categories one is already familiar with, and one must allow the reader a glimpse of Volodin's originality. The frustration with this is simply that as a translator, one must accept that readers will start to see the full extent of Volodin's originality only after a number of his texts have already been translated. Besides the Shlum chapter from Bardo or Not Bardo that I've translated, and I'm continuing to work on the translation of that book, and published in a magazine in 2009, only two books of Volodin's have been translated into English. Le Nom des Singes, which was translated by Linda Coverdale as Naming the Jungle in 1996, and Des Anges Mineurs, translated by Jordan Stump as Minor Angels in 2004. Both Coverdale and Stump are excellent translators, though you can tell just by the titles that Coverdale or her editor is willing to take slightly more liberties than Stump is. The title Minor Angels is much more faithful to its original than the title Naming the Jungle is to Le Nom des Singes. And even though I think Naming the Jungle is a good title, I think it's much better than The Name of the Monkeys would be, for instance, or anything I could come up with. But it points to a larger problem in Coverdale's translation, which is that Coverdale is willing to modify names to make the work sound more like the magic realism that American readers are familiar with. And so as a result, that book has a very different feel in English than it does in French, and it seems like it's written almost by a South American writer. And when we're talking about titles, I mean, I'll mention too a title like Bardo or Not Bardo. There's a very curious thing where the way in which accents work in French are very different from how they work in English. And so Bardo or Not Bardo, said in French or by someone who speaks French, sounds a lot more like the Hamlet's to be or not to be than it does in English. If I say it in English, the accents are on the first syllable of Bardo. Bardo. And so it's different. To be or not to be. Bardo or not Bardo. It's almost inverted. But in French, it sounds closer. So there's this curious thing where you have a title which is English, which sounds different in English than it sounds in French. And then the question becomes, how does one resolve this? Does one translate this title into French? And you can't really do that. So I don't know. I think Volodin's work raises a lot of very strange questions like that, a lot of very interesting questions. And then I think that because little things like that end up raising the question of what it means for a translation to be faithful, and also the question of faithful to what? What do we mean when we talk about fidelity in a translation? The fact that Linda Coverdale, as I said, she's actually an excellent translator, but I don't think she's excellent at translating Volodin. And very, very small changes in that book end up making it a very different experience for the reader in a way that I find working against the post-exoticism of the work. So, going back to my paper, Stump's work is more faithful to Volodin's original and is more successful, I think, as a result. This is in part due, I think, to his being a passionate reader and defending of Volodin. To successfully translate Volodin, one must have a good sense of his project as it develops from book to book. And we must maintain the sense in English of writing French in a foreign language that Volodin makes available in French. In addition, the amount of time between the two translations that appeared in English is somewhat problematic, particularly since by the time that Minor Angels appeared, 8 years after the first translation, it was very difficult to find Naming the Jungle. One of the real difficulties so far in getting Volodin genuine acceptance or widespread acceptance by English-speaking audiences is that there isn't yet a critical mass of his work available in English. What would be ideal would be an American publisher willing to publish a half a dozen Volodin books over the course of 8 years, rather than one book every 8 years, thus building up a body of work that would allow readers to glimpse his project. I think Volodin would probably be 124 by the time all his books are published if we stay on the 8-year schedule. Or if that doesn't prove immediately possible, a book every 3 or 4 years along with multiple excerpts in well-known literary magazines might at least simulate a similar effect and help build up an audience. Jordan Stumpf tries to get around the lack of critical mass by writing a brief introduction to Minor Angels, in which he introduces the idea of the post-exotic as well as concepts such as the Nara. But this only goes so far and does little to allow readers to experience the strange texture of Volodin's work. Reception of the English translation of Volodin's Naming the Jungle included comments such as these from McGill Book Reviews. Antoine Volodin's Naming the Jungle successfully mixes the stylistic and aesthetic conventions of magic realism, surrealism, and postmodernism, unquote. The emphasis is on existing styles and conventions, and Volodin is seen as someone who recognizes a set of conventions and then mixes them, rather than as the true innovator, than as the innovator he truly is. This is partly because of the very subtle choices made on the translator's part that would incline people to read moments in the text as surreal or magically real, a slight overdetermination that I think keeps the book from being clearly seen in English. Or consider this commentary from Library Journal. Quote, "Fantastic events unfold in a surreal atmosphere of unresolved questions. While not likely to generate popular interest, this novel, Volodin's first appearance in English, will appeal to readers of experimental fiction. Buy where demand warrants," unquote. Library Journal, if you don't know, if you have a good review in Library Journal, that means that probably 600 to 700 libraries will buy your book. And so it can often make the difference between a book succeeding or not succeeding, depending on what librarian chooses to write about the book. The problem with phrases like buy where demand warrants are that they are usually said by those who have no interest in pushing literature forward, who are interested in maintaining the status quo and marketing the books that will already sell instead of building up an author. Volodin is precisely the sort of writer whose appeal is that he doesn't fit into conventions. I'm convinced that there is as robust an audience for him in the United States as there is in France. Indeed, the reception of Minor Angels was quite different, partly because of the publisher of that book was much better promoting it to the right reviewers, which led to reviews that tended to be descriptive rather than imposing a genre or multiple genres on the book. Minor Angels had, according to one reviewer, quote, all the markings of a masterpiece, unquote. Another reviewer declared of Volodin that, quote, he delights in breaking down our well-honed meters of what's supposed to happen. It is out of the shambles of these once easy relationships that Minor Angels really soars, unquote. Still another called it, quote, dazzling in its epic proportions and imaginative scope, unquote. This shift in reception is also partly because American literature has shifted somewhat in the meantime, that it was at the beginning of a change that would lead to writers such as Blake Butler in 2009 and Brian Kahn in 2010. Blake Butler has two books. One is called Ever, and the other is called Scorch Atlas. Ever is a book in which it's narrated by a woman who starts to confuse her body with the house that she's living in and can't make a distinction between where she stops and where her house starts. And Scorch Atlas is a kind of series of apocalypses that he offers. Brian Kahn's book that I mentioned, Seo Enen, is called The Fixed Stars. And in my opinion, it's a book directly influenced by Minor Angels, by Des Anges Mineurs. It's a book that takes place 3 or 4 centuries in the future, in which there's a series of narratives that don't quite fit together but comment on each other in interesting ways. It's full of very strange things, like there's a play that takes place on a starship, which is in Shakespearean language, things like that. In the year that Stumpf's translation of Des Anges Mineurs was published, 2004, there was also a reconsideration of the American writer David Olley, whose 1972 debut novel Motorman was reissued in that year alongside the first printing of his second novel, The Age of Sinatra. Olley's work deals with a highly paranoid, somewhat futuristic world in a state of semi-collapse. In some senses, his novels, The Age of Sinatra and Motorman, can be read as versions of one another. They offer similar worlds, but with highly different lexicons and different specific details of the world itself. For instance, creatures called jellyheads in the first book become neutrodynes in the second book, and in doing so take on distinctly different qualities. These two novels, along with the two books of fiction Olley has released since, gave American readers of innovative fiction a model for a project that, like Volodine's, operates at a level of disjunctive synthesis. Though Olley's thrust is more parodic than Volodine's, he and the other writers I've mentioned, along with many others that I haven't mentioned, have helped to create a general, create a critical and literary space that I think is perfect for the reception of a writer such as Volodine. Indeed, there are several things about Volodine's work that make him vital to what is going on in contemporary American fiction, and which suggests to me that Volodine provides a kind of model for where innovative American fiction might go. First, there is the way in which he combines the political slash revolutionary and the non-realistic to create an intensive fictional field. He offers a series of overlapping worlds that initially seem profoundly not our own. Animals talk to humans, people transform into insects, people die and somehow go on functioning. Sometimes characters seem to be existing in the bardo, in the transitional state between death and either nothingness or reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, complete with complex hallucinations. As Volodine himself suggests, quote, je cherche à explorer et à représenter une culture non pas relativement, mais absolument étrangère, unquote. And yet, at the same time, as Marie-Pascale Huglot suggests, we recognize familiar accents, snatches of our history, bits of our own terrain, as if our world has been ground up and recycled to create his. Volodine so effectively disorients us and makes us accept the strangeness of his world that when pieces of the real world do appear in his work, it can feel very strange and very, very foreign. So, for instance, in Écrivain, when Maria 313 speaks of a series of films that include films by Bergman, Bellatar, David Lynch, and a number of others, it almost feels stranger than when he allows animals to speak. It's very, very odd context. His places seem at once familiar and strange, his character names deliberately combining elements from different language groups and places, so that it's very hard to pin down the stories he tells of death, imprisonment, and genocide as being firmly tied to any single given 20th century event. As Ruffel says, he, quote, prends soin d'en supprimer tout ancrage précis, unquote. And yet you still have the impression that, despite all this, what Volodine offers in his mercilessly strange books is access to the collective unconscious of our own political history. In a literary landscape dominated by realism, in which realism is seen as the proper way of representing reality, Volodine provides clear and compelling alternatives that are still profoundly engaged with what trouble us. He is able to present a kind of reality without resorting to the limited palette of realism. He breaks with the tyranny of mimetic fiction while still representing a coherent, albeit strange, world. The way in which Volodine transgresses boundaries between characters, narrators, narratives, implied authors, and pseudonymous authors, the way in which he focuses on storytelling, truth, interrogation, dream, and evasion, and the way in which he invents or appropriates fictional forms and operates in series such as the Shaga or the Romance, etc., radically expands the concept of metafiction as American fiction writers practice it, and gives metafiction a non-arbitrary motivation. As Ruffel suggests, Volodine's work, quote, appears as an enactment of a writing style playing with narratological positions, unquote, which calls attention to the notion of writing itself. In the place of the satirical playing with forms that one sees in authors influenced by McSweeney's, fake fictions, the fictional and parodic magazine articles that they do, the story which takes the form of a table of contents, etc., or of the reflections on the metafictional nature of myth in Robert Coover, or the intermingling of narrative and critical commentary in John Barth, Volodine offers a proliferation of metafictional strategies that muddle the distinction between fiction and reality, and that are firmly grounded in the nature of the world he's creating, motivated by the actual conditions of his characters and essential to their survival. Volodin's metafictional gestures are very much grounded within and justified by his fiction in a way that American metafictionalists' work is not. All of this ultimately leads back to my own interest both in reading Volodin and seeing his work translated into English. There's no other writer I know of so able to conjoin non-realist fiction with such honest revelation of the political unconscious of our time. There is no other writer who destabilizes narrative in a way that seems so absolute and so firmly connected to his project. In addition, there is no other writer whose project seems at once so consistent and so different and unique from book to book. Indeed, Volodin's work gives one the impression of being a living, breathing thing, a constantly developing and changing creature. It is a major, necessary project.
Merci beaucoup. Alors, je ne sais pas s'il y a des questions tout de suite sur... moi, j'avais pensé à cette question du danger de surdéterminer l'œuvre de fiction. Enfin, ça rejoint évidemment les questions qu'on a posées à l'orateur précédent sur est-ce qu'on colle aux mots, aux signifiants, enfin... Il peut refuser le mot de signifiant, je crois qu'il avait refusé le mot de signifiant, mais tu veux... Ouais.
Pardon, ce n'est pas une question, mais c'est un point d'ordre. Excuse-moi. Je pense que, comme l'heure tourne et qu'il y a l'intervention de Mirka, moi j'aurais proposé, si tout le monde en était d'accord, de donner la parole tout de suite à Mirka et de réserver les questions pour après, étant
d'accord.
Donné que je pense que certaines questions vont se recouper.
Oui, parfait.
Et je ne veux pas du tout...
Non, pas de problème, c'est mieux comme ça, je crois.
Ouais. Et donc, si vous avez, je ne sais pas ce que vous en pensez, mais... Parce que j'ai un peu peur, sinon, étant donné qu'il est déjà 6h moins 10.